United Nations voices concerns of the U.S. deportation of refugees massing along its border with Mexico. Australians take to the streets in the lockdown city of Melbourne to protest the shutdown of construction sites amid the COVID pandemic. Sudan's military says it's foiled the coup d'etat attempt, stressing that the situation is now under control. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, the United Nations is voicing concerns at the U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees massing along the Mexico border. The U.N. Human Rights Office called disturbing the images of transportation of migrants to the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. It expressed disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessment of the cases by the U.S. The UN Refugee Agency also voiced concerns at deportations and expulsions, saying that the people who have a fear of persecution in their homeland, including in Haiti, have a right to file for asylum. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. More than 12,000 refugees have arrived at the U.S. border in recent weeks. Some of them have already been sent back to Haiti. The expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the COVID pandemic. Australian police have clashed with demonstrators protesting against mandatory COVID vaccination for construction workers in Melbourne. Riot police used pepper balls and rubber ball grenades to break up the crowd. The demonstrators lit flares and attacked police cars. At least three officers got injured. Some 40 of the ralliers were also arrested. Officials have shut down construction sites for 2 weeks, linking them to several COVID clusters. All construction workers are also required to get one vaccine dose by the end of the week. The Australian city has been under lockdown for 7 weeks as it's struggling to curb an outbreak of the Delta variant. The Sudanese Prime Minister says the government will take immediate measures to ensure the country's transition to democracy following a failed coup attempt.
What happened was an orchestrated coup from parties inside and outside the armed forces, which is an extension of the attempts of the remnants of the old regime's fall in order to abort the civil democratic transition. We will take immediate measures to fortify the transition and dismantle the June 30th system, which still poses a threat to the transition.
In a televised statement, Hamdok said that Sudan has witnessed such attempts in the past, but those involved in the latest plot were arrested for the first time. He underlined that such attempts have failed to undermine the country's democratic transition. Early on Tuesday, the government said it foiled an attempted putsch involving military officers and some civilians loyal to the former regime. Government sources said that the plotters tried to take over the state media building, but they failed. Sudan is currently ruled by a transitional government composed of both civilian and military representatives. It was installed after former President Omar al-Bashir was toppled in April 2019 following months of a street protest. The Yemenis across the country have marked the 7th anniversary of a revolution that they say ended the U.S. hegemony in their country. Tens of thousands rallied in the capital Sana'a, in the northern city of Sada and the western port city of Hodeida to commemorate the revolution that happened on September 21st, 2014. Now, following that event, the government of former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi collapsed. He was backed by Saudi Arabia that even waged a war to reinstate him. The current Yemeni government is made up of different groups, including Ansarullah, that has played a major role in defending Yemen's sovereignty and territorial integrity. On Monday, Ansarullah leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that the U.S. previously used al-Qaeda to advance its hegemonic agenda. Now it's using Saudi Arabia and the UAE for the same purpose. Now let's take a look at Lebanon. Most of the lawmakers have given a vote of confidence to the new cabinet led by Prime Minister Najib Mikati. Observers say that given the economic collapse of Lebanon, the new cabinet's job will not be an easy one. Mariam Salah reports.
A lengthy parliamentary session was held in Beirut to discuss the cabinet manifesto and give the Mikati cabinet a vote of confidence. Session began with an address by the Prime Minister, who briefed the members of parliament on the most significant issues which will be dealt with.
The socio-economic challenges should be among our top priorities. The government has no way but to put its focus on reforms to pave the way for uplifting the economy, developing the productive sectors, and attracting foreign investment. In addition to these files, we need to have an independent judicial body.
Prime Minister stressed that his cabinet will directly begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, and its main objective will include the general reforms and a restructuring of the banking sector. In light of Lebanon's current dire economic descent, the majority of Lebanese lawmakers decided to give a confidence vote to a cabinet which considers itself in a state of relief efforts.
We want to give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Miqati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, or even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Miqati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022.
The Miqati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Now, in Afghanistan, the Taliban have expanded their interim cabinet, bringing in a number of ethnic minorities into it. In our news review program, we've discussed the latest developments in depth.
The Taliban have named the remaining cabinet members of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. The Taliban spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid, made the announcement during a press conference in Kabul. He said that there are no female ministers in the cabinet lineup. The Taliban announced their new leadership earlier in September, drawn up exclusively from loyalist ranks. That happened a month after the Taliban took power in Afghanistan, following sweeping territorial gains. After the takeover, the Taliban set an August 31 deadline for all foreign forces, including Americans, to leave the country. The withdrawal ended 20 years of war. Amin Alim is our correspondent joining us from Kabul, and we also have Sarbaz Ruhullah Rezvi, who's a peace and justice activist and a scholar, joining us from Qom. I'd like to welcome you both. First, obviously, over to you, Amin. Tell us more about this makeup of the government that's been finalized at this point and the breakdown, if you can.
Well, Kala, the list of the new members of Taliban's acting cabinet ministers was declared by Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid during his recent press conference here in Kabul. He said that the Taliban has struggled to include more specialized and well-experienced and, of course, educated people to the new list. For instance, we can see that there are 5 doctors, 3 engineers, and 3 national businessmen who have been appointed as the top governmental officials in this new list. However, there are at least 12 deputies appointed for different governmental bodies of the Taliban government, mainly Afghanistan's defense ministry and the country's interior ministry. Mullah Abdul Qayyum Zakir, who is considered as one of the top military commanders of Taliban, and he has well influence inside Taliban ranks, has been appointed as the deputy of Mullah Yaqub, who himself is the son of Mullah Muhammad Umar, the founder of Taliban leader, and now is leading the defense ministry of the Taliban. However, as the Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid insisted there would be no women in the framework on the or in the list of the cabinet ministers of Taliban's newly declared governmental officials, but he insisted that the government of Taliban will do its best to serve the entire nation of Afghanistan, especially the Afghan women. However, the Taliban's critics also say that given there is no presence of women in the Taliban's new list of cabinet ministers, as well as there is no exact information about the fate of many other key issues in Afghanistan, only time will tell if the Taliban will remain committed on their promises regarding to protecting many key issues such as women's rights, human rights, press freedom, and many other political issues, such as paying respect to the demands of the people of Afghanistan via giving them a share in governmental bodies, or giving specifically, I can say that giving share to specific ethnic groups in Afghanistan. The Taliban says that there are some the members of Hazara ethnic group and Tajik ethnic group and the new cabinet and the new list of the cabinet ministers.
Very well, thank you for that. Sarbaz Rulareza, you heard our correspondent there. So there's some ethnicities involved, no woman representation. Do you think this was enough, first of all, for the Afghanistan itself, and second of all, for some of its neighbors, such as Iran, who have said that they highly recommend Afghanistan and the Taliban leadership to include or to have an inclusive government? And of course, Iran's main concern, like other neighbors, are to make sure that the security is established in that country. And this is one way of at least moving towards that.
Yes, let's not forget that the names mentioned by spokesman of Taliban recently, and also those names previously mentioned, it's not just about the members of the cabinet, the minister, but these names are actually the main key authorities who are going to rule upon Afghanistan. And if we take that in our consideration, that it's not just these names are not just about the ministers, but the bigger body, the body that's going to rule upon Afghanistan, then, and we once again look to the numbers, we had 33 names previously mentioned and 4 or 5 names added by Zabihullah Mujahid in this new list. So we have 37, 38 people who are going to rule upon Afghanistan. And frankly speaking, 34 are Pashtuns. And rest of them are, as I mentioned before, non-Pashtuns, but those non-Pashtuns with Talibani background. Again, if you look to the total, number of those people designated, nothing of any inclusiveness, I think we can conclude from this list. It was mentioned Hazaras. Which Hazara is there in these 37, 38 people? Who is Hazara? There is one Tajik, Mr. Azizi was mentioned in this recent name, who is Tajik from Panjshir. The rest of them are, again, Pashtuns. So even, as I mentioned before, it's fully dominated by Pashtuns, and not Pashtuns, it's those Pashtuns who are a part of the structure of Taliban. So clearly speaking, what we have in front of us, named as the, temporary government or anything of that sort, it's a fully Taliban-dominated structure.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Sarbaz Rula Rezvi, peace and justice activist and scholar, Amin Alami. Thank you very much. Our correspondent there from Kabul. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thank you for tuning in.
Okay, let's move on with the rest of this. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres stressing the need to strengthen global governance and multilateralism.
The problems we have created are problems we can solve. Humanity has shown that we are capable of great things when we work together. And that is the raison d'etre of our United Nations. We need to strengthen global governance. We need to focus on the future. We need to renew the social contract. And we need to ensure a United Nations fit for a new era. So we'd like
Guterres made those comments while opening the 76th session of the General Assembly in New York. The UN chief warned of an increasingly divided world, urging the U.S. and China to engage in dialogue. He also underlined that the world is witnessing an explosion in attempts to seize power by force, saying that military coups are back once again. Guterres also described climate change as a planetary emergency, urging more funding to tackle the crisis. He stressed the need to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor, calling on developed states to help poor countries with public vaccination. Meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has stressed his country's readiness to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, but only if Iran returns to the agreement first. Biden made that comment in his first speech in the United Nations General Assembly since taking office. Tehran has said it will only return to the nuclear deal once it has verified the U.S. removal of all the sanctions against it. In his speech, Biden also pointed to the U.S. withdrawal of its forces from Afghanistan. He said that his country is closing a period of relentless war for a new era of relentless diplomacy. Biden said that the American military will continue to defend the U.S., its allies, and its interests against attacks. However, he added that the mission must be clear and achievable. He said that the U.S. military power must be its tool of last resort. Moscow has rejected as unsubstantiated a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that blames Russia for the poisoning death of former KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko. Kremlin spokesman says that the ECHR hardly has the authority or technological capacity to possess information on the alleged poisoning. The spokesman noted that there are still no results from an investigation into the incident. Litvinenko died in 2006 after being poisoned in a London hotel with a rare radioactive substance. On Tuesday, the ECHR ruled that Russia was responsible for the death. Britain has long blamed Litvinenko's killing on the Russian president. Moscow has always denied any involvement in that incident. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Simple Life and Cooperation in Housekeeping. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, was a man of humble means and good character. Though he had boundless riches at his disposal, he chose to adopt a simple and modest lifestyle. Despite having gained power, he was a man of few possessions. And as we all know, our Prophet conquered their hearts. And these people, they submitted to Islam, they submitted to Prophet. But despite having all this power, having all this strength, where people are ready to sacrifice everything for Islam and for Prophet, he chooses a modest lifestyle for himself. Now this is very difficult, brothers and sisters. It's easier said than done. You know, such was Prophet's desire for the reward of the hereafter. There are valuable lessons that we can learn from Prophet's household that can help us be more content with our lives. And if we look at our lifestyle today, no matter how much of the worldly blessings we have, we seem to be missing this contentment. We're not happy with what we have. We always are struggling and striving and running after to gain more. Isn't that true? It is primarily because we have distanced ourselves from the life of Prophet, from the lives of Imams, and the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. You can also include their companions with it. We distanced ourselves from their lifestyles, and hence, we're not finding that tranquility in our lives, that contentment in our lives. So the solution is to turn back to the simple life, the life of contentment and modest lifestyle. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing simple life and a modest lifestyle. And we said that if we somehow take the steps towards the ideal lives of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, we will start to feel that our lifestyle continues to become simpler and it continues to become more content. Now, there's a lot of talk about simple lifestyle, but how do we go about it, right? If we were to give you like five lessons of living a simple life, how would we go about it? Number one, choose simplicity as a lifestyle, as opposed to extravagance, as opposed to glamour, as opposed to glitter. Once we decide that I want to, as an individual, or me and my wife and my kids, we're going to lead a simple life. This is where it all begins. Once we decide, once for all, that we want simple lifestyle, this is where it begins. Number two, make the most of what you have. You know, value what you have. Don't just be, you know, thankless towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Once you start valuing what you have, you start to feel content and you start to have this lifestyle which is a happy lifestyle. Number three, if you don't need it, spend it in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Brothers and sisters, giving anything in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, especially things that we love, what it brings to our life cannot be measured. It is something very special. You just have to experience it. So if you don't need something, don't just hold on to it and keep looking at it. No, give it in the way of Allah. Somebody else can use it. Number four, don't be distracted by short-lived amusements. You know, this is another problem we see, that for very short-lived entertainment, we become so excited and we invest so much money. Look at the birthdays and look at, you know, so many other festivals that we have. They are very short-lived and they go against the ethos of living an Islamic and a simple lifestyle. Last but not the least is be driven and focused. You know, sometimes we lose focus in our lives. That leaves us with the only option of maintaining a lifestyle or attempting to maintain a lifestyle that is extravagant and that is not by any means a simple lifestyle. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
A simple question.
It seems that everyone knew the Taliban would retake Afghanistan when the Americans left. That is, everyone apart from Washington and Westminster. Even though America announced 18 months previously that it planned to leave, the British Foreign Minister, that's Dominic Raab, appears to have been taken completely by surprise by the events that followed.
Commentators point to the disastrous withdrawal of British forces, civilians and allies as evidence that the Foreign Office had no real clue about how to deal with a rapid Taliban advance.
In an ironic parody of the successful Dunkirk evacuation in World War II, Mr. Rabb had no proper plan for the Afghanistan evacuation, even though anybody watching recent news reports could see what was going to happen. The situation may have been made even worse by the embarrassing discovery that the Foreign Secretary was on holiday out of the country, for the Taliban were taking one over. The UK and USA are now locked in a bitter war of words about the catastrophic military defeat suffered by both countries. Both have lost personnel, money and credibility in this strategic implosion. Many members of the public say that Dominic Raab's poor performance has added to the humiliation in another damaging blow to the credibility of the United Kingdom, which once commanded half the world and now can't even command an evacuation. Doesn't matter that the Foreign Secretary was on holiday when Afghanistan fell. And how does the public view the current blame game between Westminster and Washington? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public think about the military disaster suffered by the United Kingdom and the United States in Afghanistan? That's what we asked the public here in London. This is what they said.
I think they could have done it better, really, because we've spent so long, 20 years, for, you know, and we haven't really helped anybody. We haven't really helped the Afghan people either. They've just been left to suffer, really.
It's awful. I mean, people are dying. We've fought with them, well, with America to look after the Afghan people, and it's just gone, it's all gone wrong. What's the point of us trying to help them if they're going to plow and leave people there to die and suffer? So
it never should have happened. We all should have helped out, and we should have never left, because it would probably affect us in the long run, but what's now done is done, and it's all the soldiers that are left injured and stuff.
It's an absolute disaster, absolute mess, shambles, and Rab should be kicked out on his backside. Never mind pretending and saying he's been doing this and that. He's absolutely hopeless. And Boris, he needs to be kicked as well, between the ghoulies. It's an absolute shambles. And Biden, Americans, what did you expect the Taliban to do? He leaves the country undefended. You've been fighting it for 20 years and you haven't won that war. And he didn't go say, okay, walk in, do whatever you want. And then say, we didn't expect this to happen. We didn't expect this to happen. Oh, I didn't expect it to happen so quickly. Absolute idiots. Absolute idiots. It's a disaster, really. And I feel sorry for Afghanistan people, because they've done no wrong. They expected protection from the British, the American, the foreign forces. And they just haven't got it. They've been badly let down. Absolutely betrayed.
I think it was absolutely terrible, really. I think there should have been a little bit more time, because all the people that actually worked for the British government never got a chance to get out, you know. So that's what I think. They should have been allowed a little bit more time, because there's going to be a hell of a lot of lives that may be taken purely because they worked for the British government or the American government. Do you know what I mean? So it's good.
We shouldn't have gone in there if we was just going to pull out like that, because the Taliban have just taken over there anyway. So what was the point in the first place?
I think what I make of it is it's just a shame. It's an absolute shame. And the more I look into it and read more about it, research it, I do think we've actually walked away and left a lot of people there that actually deserved our help and support. And I feel a bit ashamed that we just left them to their own devices, if I'm completely honest.
I think it's really sad, and I think we spent a long time over there, and it's a shame that we've all now gone back to how it was.
I think it's good we've got our troops over there, but it's good that we've got them out as well, isn't it? You know. We seem to be the country that is first in line to get involved with these things. And we're a really small country, you know.
Yeah, I think it is. Obviously, withdrawing after all this time, I think it's the timing of it all that probably makes people most upset.
I think it was very unplanned. I think they planned it very well, Afghanistan themselves, but I feel like making it public that America was going to leave Afghanistan, it took them 14 months to move in. It was 14 months of planning. It, you know, it's just very unorganised. And I
think it's atrocious of everything that's happened. I think the amount of innocent lives that have been lost due to such issues that have happened is absolutely appalling. And I think the way that both countries could have gone about it could have been a lot better, a lot more organised in it, and a lot more like clean in the way that they've like pushed towards actually trying to help. They were a bit lazy, in my opinion, on it. They kind of just took like too much time where they could have actually helped a lot more people get out.
Hundreds or perhaps thousands of British personnel, civilians and allies were left behind in the chaos in Afghanistan. What's the British public's opinion about this remarkable outcome?
It's not fair. They could have given fair enough warning. Like, they must have known that something, like, they would have done it. They must have known that they were pulling their troops out way before they did. They must have known. So to not have helped and given them the support that they needed is just wrong, really.
I think it's atrocious. We had over a year to get everybody out. We had over a year to plan. And I know we've trained Afghanistan troops, but it just didn't work out the way we planned at all.
I don't know. I think it's weakness on our part, perhaps on the American side as well. And I think it is unforgivable. It's going to be difficult, I think, if they're going to be having to go back to Afghanistan. I think they want to avoid that now, of course. But, yeah, I feel very much for those people, of course. Tragic.
I just think it's just so sad. Just so sad. And
Disorganised
as well. I don't know, we got bought into it, but we were just totally disorganised. Don't want to get too positive, but I always think leaders should always get left behind.
Left it too late. I honestly do think we should have done things before. It should have been. We knew this was going to be happening. I mean, I can remember the interpreters saying quite some time ago that they were at risk. So we were too slow. Too slow. That's why, yeah.
I mean, it's a difficult one because obviously, you have an entire population that are wanting to escape Afghanistan. And the difficulty that the government had is that obviously the American forces, the president put a deadline on when America would be pulling out, and it just wasn't possible for us to stay without that support. So, you know, the government's hands were very much tied by what President Biden did.
Well, obviously, it's criminal, isn't it, almost? I don't know what the criteria is for getting out, whether there was a criteria, or what numbers were allowed to get out, etc. Again, what do you do with people being left behind that have got legal rights to come to the UK? Do we go back in and sort those out? I'm not a military commander, so I don't know the answer to those questions.
Because we didn't plan well enough, and I think Taliban probably took people by surprise, just how so quick, although I'm not sure they did take them by surprise, but there you go.
Well, you say that, but I think at the end of the day, I don't think we realise how much the Taliban would take back control. Well, I think the biggest thing is the fact that, if you listen to Joe Biden, that there was 300,000 trained Afghanistan army, and what happened to them? Where did they go?
The British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was on holiday when the collapse of the UK-US-led presence in Afghanistan occurred. But does that matter to the public?
Well, we're all entitled to holidays, aren't we? I don't think for one minute he would have made any difference whatsoever, whether he was in Greece, wherever he was, on the beach with a towel, whatever. That'd make no difference whatsoever. At that time it was happening. A phone call wasn't going to make a jot of difference.
I don't think it's, I mean, to be honest, I think the media like stoke up an awful lot more, what was happening. You'd have probably, things happened 20 years ago, but I think the sort of scrutiny that politicians get these days, it's very much, it's amplified. I think the government, they did the best to try and work with what they got during that short time frame.
Well, did he really know what was going on behind the scenes? I mean, he went on holiday, he's got a lot of flack from it, but I think at the end of the day, like you say, they're entitled to a holiday, and I presume that he had understaff that would also take control a little bit about it and go for there, really. I mean, you can't blame him in one respect, but I know they've got said that he took the eye off the ball, but we all make mistakes, and it just goes to show that we're only human. Everyone's human, aren't we?
Well,
people go on holiday.
People do go on holiday, to be fair, but the timing wasn't great, I suppose. It is holiday season. The timing's not great, but I think they were caught unawares, to be honest with you.
Honestly, I'm not sure about the details, so I'm not quite sure exactly how many people have been left behind. I read that
seen the facts. So
I think that is absolutely unforgivable. I was reading it in the paper the other day, and you can't do that. With such an important role, you can't really be jetting off to, you know, the Mediterranean Sea and having a nice holiday. So, yeah, I think you should, his job should really be on the line as a result of what's happened, for sure.
Not so much unlucky. Again, it's a bit timing strange, isn't it, when it all happened, and to be away at that sort of time, that crucial moment, is a bit odd, yeah.
It's obviously not great. It's not ideal. I do think that mistakes have been made, no doubt about it, but I also do think that the mass media have played up to this in a degree by focusing on that and not really focusing on the other hundreds of staff members that he's got that were doing the job as well. So it wasn't great. He should have come back. But there again, he's only human. But he should have had the intelligence network behind him to say that something was in the offing that was going to go wrong.
I think it's not surprising because it's just it's anarchy, isn't it, in Afghanistan? So I think it's very difficult to discern how many people are actually there and have been left behind.
Absolute rubbish. Yeah, he's on holiday, but he has to make a call. You get off your backside and then make the call. Then you go back and relax or do whatever you want to do. But make that call. There's no excuses. Undefensible. He should be kicked out, as I said. He should be in office. And there's no honour amongst these MPs anymore. I think in the days in Parliament, if the members didn't have no confidence or honour in the Speaker or whoever is speaking, they'd turn their backs on them. I think they used to do that, didn't they? And they don't. No one's doing that. They should have done that to Dominic Raab. He should be out on his ear. He shouldn't be speaking for Britain. He's an absolute disgrace. Absolute disgrace.
It's the type of job where, whether you're on holiday or not, you pick up the phone and you are there to make sure your people and anyone else you're there to help gets out and is safe. It's not the type of job where you can go, I can leave it to next week and, you know, forget a few emails. You have to, you know, you have to be there to help them and support them, so.
The statistics of the war tell a grim story of vast expense, poor planning, and even worse outcomes. The cost of the war has been estimated at £39 billion to the UK. And in the 20 years of the conflict, over 450 service personnel have lost their lives. Now, as the war ends in British and American defeat, 17,000 people have been evacuated by the United Kingdom alone. However, the number of people left behind is unknown and could be thousands. The United States and the United Kingdom have been blaming each other for the poor exit strategy. But who does the public blame for that chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Both. They're both as bad as each other, really. They should have just put the people first. That's all it comes down to. It doesn't matter about bigwigs or Parliament or anything. It's just about the people. You need to help the people. And there's people struggling. So they're both to blame. They're both as bad as each other.
Everyone that was out there trying to fight, they should have all stayed out there, helped bring people home. It's sort of their mess in the long term.
I blame the Americans, really, to be honest. Britain only followed Americans' example, right? If they're getting people out, you know, they shouldn't have gave a deadline to get the people out at the end of August, the 31st of August, everybody has to be out of the country. Britain had no choice, they had to go, because they would have been left on their own, and most probably even a bigger target, you know, because they didn't have the backing of the Americans. So the Americans, they shouldn't have got out so quickly. It should have been allowed more time. And most probably, like the French government, they started taking their people out in May and June and things like that sort of stuff. Maybe we should have done the same thing ourselves.
I think my blame for the way it's turned out in the end game would go towards the Americans, because they just pulled out too quickly. But there again, I can see it from their side, because they've actually carried the bulk of the responsibility for this campaign for, you know, 20-odd years. And it's all very well for the rest of us to sort of sit back and say, oh, the Americans did this, Americans did that. But perhaps if the other nations in Europe, say, for example, like ourselves, Germany, France, had actually committed more resources and done our fair share, then perhaps the Americans wouldn't have walked away so quickly.
I think you've got to blame both. And they've both got a presence over there, so, you know, they should be working together, really.
America, definitely. I mean, President Trump was the first to say that America would be pulling out of Afghanistan, and then you had Joe Biden during his campaign said that he would pursue that, he would take the American troops out. He then put a deadline on it, and, you know, American intelligence clearly wasn't what it needed to be because they were taken by surprise. And to be honest, I think the comments that the president made when he blamed the Afghan government and the president, you know, they weren't perfect by any means, but to throw that blame, I thought, was horrific, to be quite frank. And I think if America had the parliamentary system that we do over in Britain, I think that they'd be looking at having a new president.
Oh, crikey, both to blame, I think. Yeah, it's all been a bit of a nightmare situation, hasn't it, for both countries? I think it's not looking good at all for both.
I don't think you can blame one country. I think it's a communal sort of, you know, effort, and I don't know whether there's any sort of EU soldiers still out there that can control things. I don't know. Working with the Taliban has got to be a must, hasn't it, now? Whether you can work with the Taliban, time will tell.
Probably America at the moment, because they're the ones most communication with the Taliban, and have really prompted the withdrawal, and then we've sort of jumped on the back of that to get ours out very quickly.
I think everyone's got to take their share of the blame. I mean, there's no tit-for-tat arguing amongst themselves. We were a coalition sort of force. NATO, I think, have been a very quiet over the whole affair. I don't think it seems to me that the Americans and the British are always the ones that take the blame. But that I suppose that's to be decided, really.
The UK have had to follow the US lead. I mean, they we're there to support them effectively. So in that sense, I think it has to fall squarely on Joe Biden, I'm afraid. And I think he's done an extremely bad job. And again, you've got to question his position, unfortunately.
I think it's both. Always in times of war or anything that's to do with like political issues and everything, they always blame each other because they don't want to take the responsibility of the actions of that has happened, and they don't want to take the blame for anything that happened. And I think both should take like responsibility for everything that's happened, and it is both like parties' fault. And I don't think war should ever happen again. I think too many lives, and it's too many people who are in higher power that are taking the role of like choosing and dictating of what should happen.
Well, I blame politics, but probably it was America really that, or the organisation of it. So probably America I would blame that thing, and on to the administration in America, really.
There's one more key question. Next time the UK is asked to assist the US in a war, what does the public want the British response to be?
I think we should be very careful not to jump into any conflicts. War is the final. That should always be the last decision. You never want to go to war. And if we were going to go to war, then it should be, you know, try to pursue peace where there is conflict. I think if America does decide that there's a new conflict on the rise and asks us to join, then let's think very hard about it.
Make our own decisions and step back and see what our country's interests are first. Are we just supporting our special friend, or is there an actual benefit to our country? You know, do we have nationals there and so forth?
If it's justified, we should do it. They are our biggest friends. I don't care what anyone else says, but they are. And if needs be, we'll defend whatever we need to defend, I think. I appreciate we're not as big as we used to be. We're only a small country, but I still like to think that we are powerful enough in appreciation to all the armed forces that we've had, the loss of life, etc., and things like that. And I mean, at the end of the day, if we have to go back to war somewhere to defend the rights of people, if we're able to do so, I think we should do so.
Yeah, definitely no. Why should we? They didn't leave us any notice to get out. They just left us stranded there, and no, wrong.
Absolutely not, because it's just there's no point. We shouldn't be their shadow. We should just do our own thing, really, and we shouldn't be getting in their petty quarrels. That's pretty much what it is. It's petty quarrels that we're getting caused into, that they started because they want to be getting their own things for themselves. They want to be more powerful, but it's not about that anymore. It's just about what's the right thing to do, especially in the economy and global crisis as well.
No. No, with a big capital no, because, you know, we got people, we lost over 450 people in that war.
And if you see the news reports about some of those people that are in wheelchairs or lost arms, legs, limbs, loved ones, you know, their sons, daughters, you know, husbands, wives, everything. You know, it's an awful lot. And those people that are left behind picking up all the pieces for that, thinking, what the hell did I do this for? This is Vietnam all over again, as far as I'm concerned. Do you know what I mean? It's, you know, it's a very, very sad way of life and things like that sort of stuff. So, no.
I think we've got to think extremely hard about it. I think modern warfare is completely different to how it was before. And, you know, we've been there for 20 years, and I think there have definitely been improvements for the Afghan people. But at the end of the day, you know, there's certain societies that you can't change in that sense. I would think very hard about that.
We should help them because it's like an ally, but not as much as what we've probably done for this one. Like, hold back a bit of what we've put out and all the efforts we've made for this one.
Depends on the individual circumstances of what's going on at the time, you know. If it's something that needs our support, then we should give it. If it's something that we think that we should spend a bit more time thinking about our response, then we should do that as well. But you can't just blanketly say, if America calls us up, should we go or not? Because that's amateurish as well, you know?
No, I think we should just, you know, if it's our war and they want to help, good. And if we really needed to save people, fine. But if it's just, you know, a minor thing that they've caused for no particular reason, just because they want to, then why should we put our men and women in danger to help them when they've done it to themselves?
Dominic Raab has faced embarrassing and some would say humiliating accusations of being unaware and absent without leave during the chaotic evacuation of UK forces and personnel from Afghanistan. He has been unable to explain why, when the American plan to withdraw had been announced in February 2020, there was still no proper plan for a British withdrawal a year and a half later. Many believe that the Afghanistan disaster isn't just a failure of British foreign policy, but that it's also evidence the UK can no longer command the respect of the world when it comes to matters of military action. In 1940, during World War II, Britain turned an urgent retreat in Dunkirk into a moral victory. Now, in 2021, the chaotic and incompetent evacuation of Afghanistan delivered the opposite message and revealed a British government and a British foreign secretary looking out of options, out of touch, and out of control.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.